But it's wild watching it because they've placed Israel into this oppressor box after the worst massacre of Jews in a single day since the Holocaust. That's what started this explosion of tension in the Middle East, was that entire families were burned alive and babies were beheaded. I mean, like, you name it, and it happened. And so in the wake of that, they've decided that this conflict, the framing of it is that the Jews are the oppressors, despite having experienced this horrible tragedy. But all of it is it all comes back to extreme progressive ideology.
Hello and welcome to the Alan Phelan Scoop. It's just me today, Phelan McAleer, coming live from New York. It's not Saturday night though. So over the last few days, we've had the first previews of our October 7th play. The previews are when you show to perhaps smaller audiences. We keep the press out. It's no reviews. It's really, it's a preview to try and iron out the kinks, a lot of the tech. I mean, this is a play, but it's actually also, you've got 13 people on stage. It's also a work of choreography. And so you try and make sure that people aren't bumping into each other, that the sound and lighting is working properly. It's been an amazing experience. We've had some audience there. So I did some interviews. I just picked random people afterwards, and I did some interviews with people afterwards and asked them what they thought of the play. So I put together this little compilation. Let's hear what the audience think of our October 7th play at the Actors Temple Theatre in New York. If you want tickets, it's October7theplay.com. But let's hear what the real audience think about it.
It was very well done. I thought it was extremely emotional to hear their voices and their stories told in their own words and not distorted the way that the world has done so over the last 7 months.
I appreciate it. And I think it's so important to hear the voices of the people who went through this. And I think that it's important for people who need to see this and to hear these voices, to hear these firsthand personal accounts of real people who have suffered immensely. And I appreciate that you have brought this to us.
Very emotional. I think the world needs to hear the voices from October 7th. And thank you for doing that and making that.
I thought it was a phenomenal performance. I didn't know what to expect, knowing what happened. You know, I followed it pretty closely, and I think you gave the voices to the people who were murdered, who survived. It was very well done, very moving.
I thought that you did a job that was just unbelievable. I thought every emotion that I could have had, I already had. And I've been there and I've seen the place since the war. And you just pulled off a very honest description of what happened there. I can't thank you enough.
I thought it was unbelievably powerful and important. I appreciated how you used the words of the people verbatim. And it conveyed the horror. It's very hard to deny human emotion and to deny the genuine feelings that the people had. Sometimes you can deny a photo, sometimes you can deny a video, but to see raw human emotion is undeniable, and it really captured the chaos, the horror, the evil of that particular day.
It was amazing to actually live it again. I've lived it for months and months. I went to Israel in January. I was at Nova. I was at the Gaza border.
Wow.
Been following it, you know, as a Jew who was once religious and now not. I feel even stronger for my Judaism, even without being religious.
The play?
And the play made me feel that also.
since October 7th, I've been more proud to be a Jew than ever before in my life.
It was so powerful, so real. It was like we were there. We heard all the bombs, the guns, the fear, everything. It's amazing.
And I have just seen October 7th, a verbatim play. And what's so extraordinary about it is there's somehow a cohesiveness to all these individual stories that were taking place simultaneously, overlapping, intersecting, and you're able to feel each one individually, but also feel the larger chaos, and at the end, a sort of contemplation and release that you wouldn't necessarily get just from one person's story in a tidy, neat arc, that it's much more complicated and much harder than that.
I think everyone should see this. I specifically think the people in my class at Columbia should come and see this.
Everyone has to come and see this production. The actors, it is just phenomenal. It took your heart out. You were actually at the Nova Festival. That's how I felt. It's exceptionally done.
I think you should use this show and show it around the world. People understand really what happened this day.
So the play couldn't have come at a better time, I think. Don't forget, this is a play. We, Anne and I, went to Israel after October 7th. We interviewed about 20 people about their experiences, about what they lived through that day, what the people they lost, the injuries they suffered, and how some of them fought back. It's a tale of tragedy, heroism, resilience. There's even humor there. And we boiled it down. We took about 13 of the stories, 12 of the stories, and we tell them, and it's all verbatim. It's only the actual words of the people we interviewed. Some of the stories are interconnecting. Some of them are standalone. Some of them standalone and then connect. And it's just this great piece of dramatic choreography, writing choreography, and the choreography on stage. It's just amazing what the director Jeffrey Cantor has done with the stage. So it's please, if you know anyone who would like to go, October7theplay.com. We're still in previews, and the official opening is next Monday, May the 13th, and then it'll be full shows, full, well, the shows are full at the moment, but it'll be, there's no going back, no tinkering at the edges then. So you can come to previews, go to October7theplay.com, or after May 13th, come to the full version of the show. So actually, let me play you the trailer of the play as well, so it'll give you a sense of just what we're trying to say and what we're trying to do. Let's play the trailer.
The world wants you to forget what happened in Israel on October 7th. We've covered many shocking stories, but nothing comes close to what the men, women and children of Israel faced that day. We're investigative journalists, Anne McElhenney and Phelan McAleer.
We travelled to Israel after October the 7th and talked to those who lived through that day. Their stories are tragic, they are moving and they are heroic. They are also very, very compelling.
We've produced a play from their stories. Our verbatim play, October 7th, consists entirely of eyewitness accounts of that day, only using the actual words of those who lived through it. The world wants you to forget about what happened that day, the day that everything changed. We refuse to let that happen.
October 7, the play, is opening in New York and will bring you the truth they don't want you to hear.
Get your tickets now for October 7, the play, at October7theplay.com, running May 2nd to June 16th in New York.
That's October7theplay.com. Thank you. Yeah, it's never been more important, I think, this play. It's needed. We felt that the world was moving on, even on October 8th, October 9th, the world was moving on. And there was a major news story. We're not Israeli, we're not Jewish, we've never been to Israel, but we are journalists, and we recognize that this story was it was kind of like a 9/11. It was an important story for Israeli history, for Arab history, for American history, for world history. And, you know, nobody was doing a first draft of history, no journalists. They had all moved on to Gaza, to Hamas, to what was happening in Gaza. They were talking about October 8th, but they weren't talking about October 7th. So as journalists, we felt that was a gap in the record. So we went to Israel and we interviewed people about October 7th, and that's all what the display is. So, and I happened to be walking past Fordham College the other day, and they were having one of their fake encampments, sort of wannabe Columbia encampment. And let's just see. I took a picture of a guy's backpack, and let's just see what the punishment is for taking a picture of a backpack in Fordham College. Well, actually, no. Let me talk about it first. So, as you can see, they tried to crowd me out, stop me from taking pictures, blocked my camera, physically shoved me, and then this delightful. And then they were all wearing masks, and then this delightful creature there. You'll see her towards the end, the one with the exquisite finger. She fired a bottle, smacked me on the side of the ear. So let's play that video now.
Sir,
why did you threaten me?
I got you now. I got your picture.
Why did you threaten me? Why did you threaten me?
Sir, what's your name? Are you a student here?
Whoa.
Don't back into me, ma'am.
Thank you for seeing
me. Don't back into me. Sir, what's your name? Why did you feel you could threaten me? What's your name? Are you a student here? Why, if you want to bump into me, why won't you show your face? Why won't you show your face? Oh.
Get the full thing. If you have my ID, we can talk about it.
Why do you not want your face shown? She fired water at me.
After I stopped filming, they got the police. Then these anti-police protesters, you know, disbanded the police. Then decided, were so upset that they got the police to take me out because I was causing trouble. I explained to the police and as respectfully as I could, perhaps disrespectfully slightly too, that I wasn't going to tell them how to do police work if they wouldn't tell me how to do journalism, and that my work was protected by the First Amendment, by the way, by many amendments, the right to travel, the right to take pictures, the right to do journalism, and that if I'm doing journalism and people are violent towards me, they're the lawbreakers, I'm not. So after I explained that to them, perhaps not as calmly as I'm explaining this now, they let me back in so I continue to do my work. So I want to talk about these issues with someone who, as you'll hear, I've admired from afar for a long time, a really great presence in journalism and on Twitter, Bethany Mandel. So let's go over to the interview I did earlier with Bethany Mandel, and we cover a lot of ground, and I'm really glad we do, because it's great to just have a conversation with someone rather than doing a straightforward interview. This is a conversation about the world. And let's go over to that interview now. So this is one of the pleasures of having your own podcast. You get to meet your heroes. I'm joined now by Bethany Mandel, author, journalist, and commentator. She co-authored a book called Stolen Youth, How Radicals Are Erasing Innocence and Indoctrinating a Generation. She's also a homeschooling mother of six young children and running for the school board in Montgomery County, Maryland, or as we say in Northern Ireland, Maryland. Bethany is a fearless voice on Twitter, where I've been watching her from afar, and I'm very, very excited to have her on the Alan Phelan Scoop. Thank you for joining us, Bethany.
Thank you so much. What a kind, wonderful, warm welcome. I also have admired you from afar for many years, and it's so out of body to know that, like, my watching from afar was your watching from afar, and we should have just not been from afar.
Yes, yes. Well, thanks for coming on. I so much I want to talk. We could talk the whole podcast. Let's talk about the book you wrote, because I think it's got a relevance to what's happening in the world today. As they say in journalism, never be too right too early. I think you were too right too early. So you wrote a book about the leftist indoctrination of youth last year. Is that how that's connected to these university protests? And is it just, you say it's not just the result of leftist faculties or curriculum. There's more going on. Tell us.
Yeah. So it's funny because when we were writing it, we were afraid we would be late to it. But it's just going on and on and on and on. Yeah. My co-author, Carol, just wrote a great column, actually, for the New York Post that came out on Monday, the 6th. I don't know when you're airing this, but it talks about how all of the anti-Semitism we're seeing on college campuses, it doesn't start from point A when a student enrolls in college. It starts from the K-12 area. On Wednesday, there's going to be a K-12 hearing on anti-Semitism on the Hill. And there's, an entire law firm called the Deborah Project, and all they do is tackle anti-Semitism in the K-12 sphere. And they're overwhelmed. I was actually just talking to one of the lawyers today, and she said, like, I can't breathe, let alone answer emails, because it's just, I'm getting constant messages. And the whole framing of the book, we didn't actually talk about anti-Semitism, but we talked about sort of woke indoctrination in schools. And it's the genesis of all of it is the same. It's this idea that there are oppressors and there are oppressed, and putting people in those boxes, oppressed, oppressor, and everything is very black and white and not very inquisitive, not very historical very often. And unfortunately, Jews have been put into the oppressor box because, anti-Semitism, but the IDF exists, happens to be particularly good at its job. But it's wild watching it because they've placed Israel into this oppressor box after the worst massacre of Jews in a single day since the Holocaust. That's what started this explosion of tension in the Middle East, was that entire families were burned alive and babies were beheaded. Like, you name it, and it happened. And so in the wake of that, they've decided that this conflict, the framing of it is that the Jews are the oppressors, despite having experienced this horrible tragedy. But all of it is it all comes back to extreme progressive ideology. And in our book, we decided to sort of look at every individual facet of a child's, younger child's life, and how it's pervasive in books, in movies, at the doctor's office, at school, and sort of take it from there.
I mean, it's truly shocking when you think about it that there's a law firm in the United States of America dedicated to combating anti-Semitism in the years K-12. And now we have a lot of listeners abroad. K-12 is how old are those kids?
5 to 18.
5 to 18. So from 5 years.
It's happening with 5-year-olds. Yeah. Like, that's
there's a law firm that can't cope with combating anti-Semitism. I mean, you hit it on that's the key as well, the oppressor versus oppressed. I don't know if you study journalism or have read much about journalism, but we were always told, as at school and journalism and all. Journalism is about afflicting the comfortable and comforting the afflicted. And to be honest, that never sat really well with me, even when I was a boring leftist, because you meet a lot of afflicted people and sometimes they're right bleep holes, right? Just because you've had a bit of affliction doesn't mean, you know, that you that you're a good person, or that the person, the comfortable, especially, and just because you're a comfortable person, no one knows how you got to be comfortable. No one knows your story. Why should we be afflicting you? Why should kids think that there's this dichotomy and that the comfortable person is the bad person and the afflicted person? Maybe you're afflicted because you were a bleep hole. You know, there's all these, the idea that journalism or life or education should be about certain groups and you give sympathy to this group and not to that group. It's a bad recipe.
I'm also a former leftist. Maybe that's why we like each other so much. But it's funny. And my friend Batya Unger Sargon talks a lot about this, because the way the journalism is, it's like this. It's people who don't understand how disconnected they are from reality because they do have that framework. But at the same time, the journalists are elites. They are people who can afford to go to Columbia, go to NYU, go to these schools, take on, well, they don't actually take on the debt. Their parents just pay in cash, but pay these tuitions and then have internships that are unpaid, take $30,000 a year jobs, all of these things. You can only do that if you come from privilege. Yeah. And so these are privileged people who have the chutzpah to lecture the rest of us about oppressor versus oppressed. Meanwhile, like, they've never had to wonder how they're going to choose between paying for gas and paying for their groceries.
Yeah.
That's not an experience these folks have ever had.
No, there's so much you've said there. I mean, by the way, Batya was at the play last night. Loved it. She wrote this amazing email to us. The play is amazing. I hope you can come. But you talked there about, yes, the toughest part of journalism now is not getting into journalism school, is not getting published in your student magazine. It's actually being able to survive for the first year or two in the unpaid jobs or low-paid freelance jobs. And that, if you don't come from some kind of wealthy background or middle-class, upper-middle-class background, you can't get your start in journalism. And it's all about getting the cuttings, as we used to call them. You know, it's so when you go for a real job in a year or so, or when you apply for the staff position at the place you've been interning at, they know the cut of your jib. They know what you're capable of. But if you, how can you survive a year with on low pay or no pay unless you're from privilege? And that, as you say, is a self-selecting group of journalists.
And to be totally honest with you, I did not come from that background. I grew up in a trailer park, single mom. My parents both died when I was in my teens. The only way I've been able to survive for the first literally 10 years of my career was because we viewed my income as expendable. And I didn't make that much. I was home with our kids. And so all the work that I've done for the last 10 years has been, you know, pocket money for us. And my husband is the breadwinner, which, by the way, he's also a journalist, but he's 5 years my senior. And so he was at a point in his career where he was making something.
Mm-hmm.
But there were years of, especially our early careers, that we didn't live in an apartment that had working heat.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just sort of like, we were passionate about what we were doing. And we decided like, we were going to play the long game and pray it worked out. And it did. That's what we had to do in order to get to this point in our careers.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of drifted off topic there, but actually, it's a very important point about journalism and journalists. I mean, I could sit and talk about journalism all day, and I think people need to know how the sausage is made and how journalists end up, how that person you see on TV ends up on TV, and it's not. There are great journalists who just cannot afford, and there are people, I mean, even go on Facebook or Instagram now, you see people writing about things and you think, that's a brilliant piece of writing, and there's some guy in Ohio, but they can't afford to give up their real job and go and work for nothing for a year or two to get established. So we're losing that authentic voice for the boring homogenized voice of the East Coast, West Coast. And by the way, you can live in Missouri and in a city in Missouri and still have an East Coast, West Coast journalism view. In fact, they all want to be that. They all mimic the East Coast, West Coast journalism, all the journalists in Missouri. But let's go on. Let's talk about what's happening now. What do you think is so appealing about the Palestinian cause to these affluent students? Why are they getting out of bed and putting on a mask and punching journalists?
Yeah. I mean, there was a really funny meme that was going around that said, like, I support the latest thing. And it was like Matt flags behind them and the mask and the shots. And it's just like, whatever the latest thing is what they support. And they support it wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
And so, if you want to rewind 4 years, almost exactly, the masks, then the vaccines, then Ukraine. What else have been the latest things? This is Taylor Swift is somewhere in there. Let's just say.
Don't be saying that. Now we have some very big Taylor Swift fans in this company.
Right. But like, she is the thing that everyone loves. And this is like how to be admitted into polite society is to always wear a mask dutifully. And don't question like, why would we wear a cloth piece of fabric on our faces and think that's stopping a virus on a 2-year-old? That doesn't make it. You're not allowed to ask those questions. And so if you look at the videos from these protests, there was this influencer named Montana Tucker. She went to UCLA and this like gorgeous blonde, and she walked around with a camera and she said like, why are you here? And she doesn't look like a journalist. She looks like a gorgeous influencer because she is. And no one would talk to her. Yeah. And everyone was scared because they can't really verbalize what they're doing and why they're upset. And so a lot of it is just ignorance. What's, I think, been most surprising about all of these protests is to find out. It's like the Emperor Wears New Clothes moment just continuing for the last 4 or 5 years. But how profoundly stupid a lot of these students are who are at Ivy League schools.
Yeah, so I happened to be walking past Fordham College here in New York, and there was a protest on. They were doing a, you know, they're probably not as good as Columbia, so they're doing a kind of half-assed encampment. But I went into the crowd, and I support the latest thing. There was a guy, and he had a backpack, and on the backpack was Bernie for president, George Floyd, this, and all these badges.
Yep.
And I looked at it, and I saw, if I took a picture like this, there's a guy standing with a Palestinian flag and then the Fordham University thing. And I thought, that's a good picture. So I took it. They surrounded me and fired a bottle and smacked me on the ear for taking that picture. And I thought it was kind of a cute picture, actually. You're identifying my personal details. I'm going, you have badges on the back of your rucksack. You know, I thought it was kind of a cute picture, you know, with the three aspects. But you're right. I think maybe they understood it better than I did. I realized I was taking the picture because I thought it's the latest thing without articulating it's the latest thing. But they knew I was making fun of them as the latest thing. So that cannot be tolerated.
And it's really, truly the last 5 years have been an Emperor's New Clothes moment where we've realized like the experts, quote unquote, do not know anything.
Yeah.
And it's honestly terrifying. And I'm not even just talking about COVID, like the advent of Twitter and having some people who ran the CIA, for example, and having them have a Twitter account. James Comey on Twitter is one of the most terrifying things I've experienced in my adult life because I've realized, oh my God, this man was really, really powerful for not an inconsequential amount of time.
Yeah.
And he is actually a crazy person and sort of a moron as well.
Are we talking about Comey or Brennan? It's hard to distinguish between the two of them.
Both of them.
Brennan ran the CIA and Comey ran the FBI. And
right. Thank you.
Honestly, I know that because I know more about Comey's emails than he does probably at this stage because we did the FBI Lovebirds play, and when you see Peter Strzok, you know, was known as one of the best counterintelligence agents in the United States. The guy was texting his lover the most embarrassing things on an FBI work phone.
It's wild. It's wild. It's funny. My kids' camp had like a questionnaire, like their summer camp. A lot of kids have come to camp with trauma from COVID. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you want to share about your child's experience of COVID? Mm-hmm. And me being like snarky, I wrote, she's developed a healthy distrust of authority. That's what she's learned, to question literally everything. And she does. They all do now.
Yeah, I wonder if... funny, I had someone on the show last week, Bev Jackson from the LGB Alliance, and who were the big people who really pushed the British government to end the trans madness in the UK. And, you know, she's an old lefty lesbian, as she would call it herself, progressive, pro-abortion, all that. And I meant to ask her, and I didn't, you know. So they have basically overturned NHS policy, British government policy. So the trans madness is hopefully coming to an end in the United Kingdom. But they have never been on the BBC once, right? The BBC have never interviewed them once. Now, and the BBC is not like PBS here, that's kind of an obscure... The BBC has 60% of the market, sometimes 70%, sometimes 80%. It carries the Queen's speech. You know, it's a major broadcasting and journalism force. And they've never been on once. And I should have asked her, so you know now how your cause has been treated by experts and the mainstream media. Does this make you think maybe the climate thing isn't... Because we're told there this is scientific consensus, and we're told there's all these experts. Maybe that, and I never hear anyone disagree with that on the BBC, so maybe that's the same thing. I wonder, I mean, I know, I can't go into too many details. I know someone who is a very, very famous personality, a very, very famous actor, comedian. I can't go into too many details, but they said something about something, and there's an attempt to cancel them, and they're still there, but they're just about, but it's meant they're hanging around with some reprobate right-wingers. And they're working with these right-wingers on certain things. And so they spent weeks with these right-wingers, and they were going... And, of course, they realized, wow, these people are actually nice and intelligent and articulate and disagree and agree to disagree. And then at one stage, he just turns to the right-wingers and he goes, now, I know the media and everything, they're all wrong about this, and this is important, and the experts are wrong. But surely, tell me it's not like that about climate. And they go, sorry, it is. And he goes, oh, no. So suddenly he's having to realize perhaps everything I know isn't true. So anyway, that's a long way of asking a question. I'm not even sure if there is a question in there, but what do you think of that?
So Seth and I call it the Economist phenomenon, where we would read The Economist. Seth and I loved it. And this was back when we were super duper poor. And we would I think we were dating. I don't even think we were married yet. And we split an Economist subscription, and it was not an insignificant cost. And we found ourselves sitting there and reading it and thinking, like, how freaking bad is their Israel coverage? Like, who are they talking to? What are they doing? Have they ever even talked to an Israeli when they write all these pieces? And then I sat there and I moved on to like India, for example. And I thought to myself, who's saying that the India coverage is right? I don't know if it's right. I don't know anything about India. That's why I read The Economist. But if I didn't know anything about Israel, I would think they're right. And they're very, very wrong on this.
What year was this?
Gosh. 15 years ago?
Okay. I was writing the Romania-Bulgaria coverage for The Economist then. So
was it right?
So, and I was left a big boring lefty then. So you're probably reading my coverage about Romania and Bulgaria. And but in The Economist's defense, about 20 years ago, they did run a number of climate skeptic columns, and they had climate skeptic editorials. That's all gone now. It's all gone. One thing that struck me, again, we're back to journalism, but actually journalism's important. People need to know that just how to be, you know, don't trust the media, which is sounds a terrible thing to say as we're both in the media, but don't trust us. But there's another group of people I want to talk about. These university administrators who've suddenly decided that they want to protect free speech on campus. It's sacred, in fact, free speech, and it's very, very important. That's why they've allowed a lot of these pro-Hamas protests. And who could object to free speech? So I'm sure Jewish groups have had protection, same kind of protection all along. And I believe you've had some experience of that protection at Rutgers.
Yeah, so it's funny. I've been helping a couple Rutgers students navigate everything that's going on. Mm-hmm. And it's terrifying what's happening there. A girl was standing next to the encampment. So the encampment is not allowed, okay? Quote unquote, not allowed. Mm-hmm. Are there consequences? Not only are there not consequences, the administration gave in to 8 of their 10 demands. Mm-hmm. So the opposite of consequences. When Jewish students were standing next to the encampment, they, people were telling them October 7th was like the Warsaw Uprising, that Hitler would have loved you. Mm-hmm. No disciplinary consequences for those students. Mm-hmm. But Jewish students wanted to have a barbecue, like literally a barbecue at a park on campus. And they were told, if you follow through with this barbecue, you will face certain disciplinary consequences, like for sure disciplinary consequences. Mm-hmm. And so they decided that they couldn't risk it. And so they held it off site, but this is, or off campus. But this is the situation facing Rutgers students. And it's gotten to the point where there's like real panic among people who have worked in Jewish life on this campus for 20 something years, where they're wondering, like, I don't think that there's a future for Jewish students here because it's going to be overrun by people who are anti-Semitic and hostile to Jewish life. Mm-hmm. And it's awful because it's a public university. New Jersey is like one of the highest concentration of Jews outside of the state of Israel. And it's going to get to the point, if it's not already there, I think it is, that Jewish students are not safe on public university campus.
Yeah. Yep. And I mean, have they, what's their justification for this? I mean, have they tried to explain it? Has anyone, of course, the media hasn't asked them hard questions.
So the New York Post reported on it, and I talked to the reporter, and he called the university for comment. Like, do you see the blatant discrepancy in how you're treating these two groups? Which, in my opinion, is a Title VI violation. Mm. And in my opinion, I'm not a lawyer or anything resembling one. And they didn't respond to his request for comment.
No response.
Yeah.
So we're... This is Holocaust. We're recording this on Holocaust Remembrance Day. So what's the mood of the Jewish community in America? And I suppose there's a question everyone wants to know. Do you think this, I mean, this may sound crass, but I suppose it's interesting to know as well. I mean, do you think that the Jewish community have become more skeptical of the media now? Do you think also they've become more skeptical of the Democratic Party? Do you think they will not vote for Biden? Do you think they will vote for Trump? That's a lot of questions there, but what's your feeling?
So there's no monolithic Jewish community. Yeah. There's people who happen to be Jewish, mm-hmm. and there's people who live their Judaism every single moment of the day.
Yes.
And those are very different people. And so people who happen to be Jewish often have not really received an adequate Jewish education. Mm-hmm. They're not adequately Zionist, in my opinion. Yeah. They don't understand why Judaism and Zionism are, you cannot unlink them. And so for those folks, I think their religion is their progressive politics. And it's so bad that the Reform movement of Judaism here in America, all of their activism is progressive activism. It's mm-hmm. it's not even remotely resembling anything related to Judaism. They talk about, you know, reproductive rights is a Jewish value. No, it's not. It's really not. The ADL has had a really interesting transformation since October 7th.
Yeah.
Because for the first time, they're like, huh, maybe we've not been taking care of our literal mission for the last 15 years.
Yes.
And so they have faced actually a lot of staffers who have quit because of how the ADL has handled post 10/7. And that says something about how it was run prior to 10/7.
So the staffers have quit because they're actually tackling anti-Semitism, or the staffers have quit because they're not? Tell me.
Because they are tackling anti-Semitism, because they're actually, they had Jared Kushner give a speech at an ADL conference recently, which is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
So I think that the ADL is coming to its senses too little too late.
Too little too late.
But their staff, their like core staff, they're facing a lot of resignations because tackling actually anti-Semitism was not why they signed on. They came on to be a bludgeon for the Democratic Party. Yeah. And now that they're not necessarily that in their job description so strictly, they're not comfortable with how the direction the ADL is taking.
I mean, you bring up so many good points. You know, it reminds me when we did a lot of work on climate in the 2008 and 2009 and all around them. And there was a real debate about climate then. And I remember speaking to some representative of a billionaire, and they said, "We love your movie, and you know, and we're working with this group and that group, and we've got the unions as well. The unions are going to be really right behind us, you know, on this, because this is union jobs." And I'm sitting there thinking, okay. And of course, the unions weren't, because the union leadership, they're not interested in union workers. They're interested. They could just tomorrow resign and go and work for the ADL. They could just go tomorrow resign and go and work for Planned Parenthood. You know, they're activists. It doesn't matter what the issue is. It's all about pushing a progressive message. So the union, you know, the mine workers and the steel workers union leadership didn't care about them losing jobs. They cared about pushing a progressive message. And it sounds just like the ADL. They didn't actually care about defamation or, as it's known, anti-Semitism. They wanted to push the Democratic Party, climate change, abortion, gay marriage, whatever the menu of the day
is. The cause of the day.
Sorry?
The cause of the day. The
cause of the day. Yeah, so I mean, has there been a call for a reckoning with the ADL leadership? I mean, look, Sacha Baron Cohen has suddenly woken up. But Sacha Baron Cohen made an absolute fortune going around America pretending that ordinary Americans were racist and anti-Semitic. By the way, remember he sang this song, "Throw the Jew Down the Well," at a rodeo, and got everyone to sing along. And of course, they were all kind of not really understanding what it was. And you know, and there was an ad on TV, I think it was by the ADL, you know, where the guy's in a white pickup truck, and the son has put messages on the internet, and the father's telling him to apologize, but they're in a white pickup truck, and suddenly I think the ADL have, as you say, too little too late, realized the true enemy is not driving a white pickup truck. The true enemy is driving a Subaru, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that we're far enough past October 7th to have that reckoning moment. But I know that I think a lot of the donors to the ADL realized the mistake they made, and that led to a little bit of a shift on the ground. But I mean, my husband Seth has been writing for Commentary Magazine for years about the rot in the ADL. Mm-hmm. And he's spoken to so many former staff members who felt like it had gone astray. They don't even have anti-Semitism in their mission statement right now.
Wow. No way.
They took it out. They don't believe that that's a core part of their mission anymore. Where do you do with that?
What was the justification for taking it out? Because anti-Semitism didn't exist?
We don't know. They just disappeared. One day someone noticed it and tipped us off. No longer is there anymore. I don't know if it's back. I haven't looked. But it was gone.
These are... Well, with friends like that, who needs enemies, you know?
Right?
Yeah.
So anyway, there's Jews like that. To answer your original question, there's Jews like that. And then there's Jews who like wear a yarmulke and have, you know, been punched in the face in Brooklyn for the last 10 years. And you know, there's been terrorist attacks here in America. There was a supermarket shooting. There was a stabbing at a Hanukkah party. Like, Jews who live their Judaism every day, mm-hmm. if you look at a voting map of New Jersey for, you know, the last election, presidential, you will see giant, weird pockets of deep, deep, deep red. And those giant, deep pockets are Lakewood, New Jersey, where, you know, 95% Jewish and Orthodox Jewish, mm-hmm. not like wishy-washy Jewish, actually Orthodox Jewish.
Yes.
And so you see that super blue state actually has very, very dark, deep pockets of red. And it's in these Jewish towns. Well,
that's why for the last 5 years, we've been seeing all these TV shows about the Orthodox Jewish community being basically evil. I can't remember what was that. Yeah, that TV series, Orthodox, that Unorthodox. Medical show where they had the two guys saying we can't take an organ transplant from a non-Jew. So they realized that there was a pocket of the Jewish community that voted for Trump. So they did everything they could to tarnish their name.
It wasn't just Trump. It's a hostility to anything religious. And it extends to, I mean, anyone who has faith tends to vote a certain way. And so it's very easy for them to write off anyone who has faith because they are the baddies. They vote badly. They breed badly. We have too many kids. We don't care about the environment. Like, you name it. Like, we're the baddies.
You breed badly. Very good. Very good. Well, on breeding, I think we'll have to leave on the words breeding badly. So thank you very much, Bethany, for coming on. I hope you get up to New York to see the play. I realize you're rather busy there. Oh, we didn't even talk about you running for school board. Go ahead. Sorry, tell me about your running. So why is a homeschooling mom running for school board?
Yeah, so I live in the way that the schools work in America is that you are stuck where you live in your zip code. And so my local school, where my children would go if they weren't homeschooled, less than 10% of the kids can do math or read on grade level at my kid's age at fourth grade.
Wow.
So sending them to that school would be deeply unfair. We have the privilege, and progressives don't use that word anymore since COVID because they stopped caring about privilege, but we have the privilege that I have flexibility, and we've built that into our lives. I have the privilege to homeschool them. And so we do, in order to give them an adequate education. I was raised by a single mother. I'm an only child. What would she have done if we were living here and this were the situation? Every kid in my zip code should have access to an adequate education, not just the kids that are privileged enough to have parents who will homeschool them or send them to private school. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of take my upbringing into consideration when I think about all these kids who don't have a chance, mm-hmm. that we should live in a meritocracy and we don't. But also, I think it's funny that my homeschool children, we have to register and report to public school authorities, public education authorities in this county and in this state. And who are they to tell me that I'm doing it right or wrong when 7% of kids in fourth grade in their schools that they're the experts of can read? Why should I have to answer to you? Yeah. And yet I do. And so I unfortunately have skin in the game because I have to answer to these people. There's a lot of taxpayers in Montgomery County who have children who are, you know, unfortunately in the same position that I am, that we're still subjected to the rot in this county. And it's leading to all sorts of things that are societal problems like crime. Mm-hmm. The crime situation in our schools is off the charts. It affects everyone. And it will just keep on getting worse if we're not giving kids adequate education. And that's the situation. And unfortunately, because I live in such a deep blue city and state and county, mm-hmm. It's run by a machine. It's run by people who don't care about anything but their own next political agenda. Yeah. I don't have political ambitions. I don't want to run for Congress. I don't want to be on the county council. Mm-hmm. But all of the folks who are on the school board or running for the school board have further ambitions, and they're using the school board as a stepping stone. And they're stepping on our kids in the process.
Totally. Okay, well, thank you very much, Bethany. Hope we can get you up here to see the show It's amazing, and I do say that myself, but lots of other people are saying that as well. So thank you very much for coming on the show, and all the best.
Thank you so much.
So, a pleasure to interview Bethany. I really hope that she can come up to the play. It's an amazing play. Everyone who's seen it agrees. And Bethany is an amazing journalist, and I hope to have her back on the show again. So I just wanted to really end today with, I was reading the Irish Times, which is like the New York Times, only worse, the paper of record in Ireland. And I saw this. They have a problem page, only they don't call it a problem page because that would be too sort of working class. So they have a problem page. It's called Your Wellness. And it's called, you know, so it's under the wellness section, and it's called Ask Roe. So Roe is a person, R-O-E. Let's put it up, the latest problem there. So my partner has become increasingly right-wing and conservative in his worldview. He's a great person otherwise, and I love him dearly. I desperately want him to revert to the person he was before. So they're living in America. This couple, they're Irish and they want to come home, but she just doesn't know how to handle his increasingly right-wing conservative attitudes. And let me sum up what Roe advises. Roe advises the woman to dump this man now if he's not going to change his opinions. And can you imagine? So what that woman is really saying is this man has become more conservative, more into family, more into love of country, more into rules and discipline and faithfulness and orderliness and freedom, by the way. He wants people to have the freedom to express themselves, not to be restricted and not to be cancelled. And Roe is telling this woman this is a disaster for her personal life. She has to leave now. Someone who wants... And you know that in 10 years' time, this woman who has this problem is going to be writing back to Roe and saying, "Dear Roe, I'm 38. I can't find a man who wants to settle down and have a family. They all want to have one-night stands or use me and abuse me. What can I do?" And I don't know what Roe's going to say then, but maybe what she should say is, why don't you go back to that guy who became more conservative, more right-wing? Because part of that deal is pro-family, respect, pro-rules, pro-conservative, pro-not being liberal but not being libertine in one's attitudes. Let me read... You know, I mean, and Roe has this weird idea that Western conservatism does not focus on building, developing, or creating anything that doesn't involve limiting the rights of others. Look, there's one side of the argument that want to be in your fridge to check what kind of milk you're drinking, they want to look at your light bulbs, they want to look at your car, they want to restrict the kind of car you drive, they want to restrict where you go on holidays because of the climate, they want to restrict your eating meat, they want to restrict what you can teach your children, how you can teach your children. And there's another group, the conservative group, that says, leave me alone. Leave me alone. Leave my family alone. Let's see what else she said. Honestly, in 10 years' time, this woman is going to be writing back to the Irish Times. I'm 38, and despite going to all the right liberal protests supporting Palestine and the Intifada, I can't meet a decent man. What's wrong with me? We should just send her column from 10 years previously. That wasn't the only thing. The other headline in the Irish Times that caught my eye, significant minority of Irish people now believe in conspiracy theory, research shows. Okay. And then there's a little subhead. Polls show 59% each of respondents believe most politicians, quote, only care about the interests of the rich and powerful. So believing politicians only care about the interests of the rich and powerful is now a conspiracy theory, according to the left-wing Irish Times. How the world has flipped. It used to be the leftists who were complaining about billionaires and millionaires. And the rich and powerful. And now, because they get all their support from billionaires and millionaires, they believe it is a conspiracy theory to have any negative feelings towards billionaires and millionaires. So, look, we'll put those articles up. We'll put links to those articles up. You can get more on that on the show notes on the YouTube. Don't forget to leave your comments. We read them all, and we actually pay attention to them as well, and we try and change the show sometimes to match your comments. So please go to, if you want to go to the play, October7theplay.com. If you don't want to go to the play, if you can't go to the play, if you're not in New York, please think about donating. We're the only play in New York that is under police protection. Think about that. We have our own private security, which is very expensive, but we actually have a police officer outside the play at all times. So the private security is not cheap. It's just under $50,000 for the run of the play, $50,000. So please donate what you can. Help us out. Go to October7theplay.com. Send the links, send the social media to anyone who might help promote the play. We need your help. It's a wonderful play. It's worth spreading. And it's worth seeing, and it's worth supporting. So go to October7theplay.com. Thank you.
The world wants you to forget what happened in Israel on October 7th. We've covered many shocking stories, but nothing comes close to what the men, women and children of Israel faced that day. We're investigative journalists, Anne McElhenney and Phelan McAleer.
We travelled to Israel after October the 7th and talked to those who lived through that day. Their stories are tragic, they are moving, and they are heroic. They are also very, very compelling.
We've produced a play from their stories. Our verbatim play, October 7, consists entirely of eyewitness accounts of that day, only using the actual words of those who lived through it. The world wants you to forget about what happened that day, the day that everything changed. We refuse to let that happen.
October 7, the play, is opening in New York and will bring you the truth they don't want you to hear.
Get your tickets now for October 7, the play, at October7theplay.com, running May 2nd to June 16th in New York.
That's October7theplay.com. Thank you.